The Senate needs two, I know.
It's Holmberg's.
We might as well get the Legacy and Budget Stabilization Fund Advisory Board meeting called to order. I guess we need a roll call.
Representatives, Chairman Kempinick?
Here.
Kreitz?
Here.
Senators, Vice Chair Klein?
Here.
Sinnet?
Here.
Mr. Hardmeyer?
Here.
Mr. Rauschenberger?
Here.
Ms. Sharp?
Here.
You have a call?
Okay. Next on the agenda, consideration of minutes of the June 15th meeting.
Move they be approved.
Was moved.
Second.
Second. Do we need a voice vote on that, or just? Just, okay. Okay. Any other comments or anything? Okay. Well, I guess we can start with the 905 one. Is Mr. Hunter, there he's hiding behind the podium. Is, I guess we can go through what you kind of put together here in this here, and then we'll.
Very good, Mr. Chairman.
Questions as we go through, I guess, and stuff, so.
Very good. Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Dave Hunter. I serve as the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the Retirement Investment Office, and have done so, had the privilege of doing so since December 2nd of 2013. By all means, I'm going to go through some prepared materials to address the status of the Budget Stabilization Fund and Legacy Fund, as well as the asset allocation, net investment returns, and the basis points charged by investment managers that the Legacy Fund and Budget Stabilization Fund pay each year. Overall, it's a very positive story on a policy benchmark perspective. Absolute returns are not exactly where we would like them to be, and that's just a function of the overall economic conditions in the capital markets over the past year. But from a policy benchmark perspective, we're doing a nice job of creating excess return. So without further ado, I'm going to refer to this presentation that hopefully everyone has a copy of. On page 2, dealing with the Budget Stabilization Fund, we're going to talk about the status first. So going back to fiscal year 2006, we started off with a little under $100 million in contributions. It's increased pretty much every year since then, with a few exceptions. Fiscal year 2014, we ended up with about $586 million in assets. Because of the revisions to the policies and the cap, we actually had a $23 million disbursement that we implemented in June of this year. $11 million of that was principal, and $12 million of that was income, and that's what you see there. So that's the reason why you see the decrease from $586 million down to $573 million for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2015.
How much did you say was principal?
$11 million was principal, and a little over $12 million was income.
And that went into the general fund, right?
And that went into the general fund, yes. So Clay Canyon's first year we've done it, that was the largest distribution we've made in the history since 2006. The next page deals with the asset allocation. This is about as straightforward as it gets. It is 100% asset allocation to short-term fixed income and Bank of North Dakota CDs. Why is it 100% fixed income and short-term CDs? It's because this is a rainy day fund. It's meant to be liquid. It's meant to provide wonderful capital preservation. It has a lower expected return effect than our legacy fund overall. It has probably about a 2% expected return, and that's about what we're generating going forward.
Any questions, committee? One of the things that, you know, when you look at, and we've gone through this before, and on the short terms, but they're okay. Our longest out though on the short terms is like what, 3 years?
Yes. Yeah, so Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, we invest with Babson and J.P. Morgan for the vast majority of the assets, about 80%. It's highly liquid investments. Generally, the vast majority of that can be tapped within 5 to 10 business days, even during a stress environment. Probably the least liquid that we have is the Bank of North Dakota CD investments, but based upon discussions with the President Eric Hardmeyer of Bank of North Dakota, as well as Tim Porter, who serves as CFO, there's good liquidity there. It's something that we work with the Bank of North Dakota to make sure that if we ever did need to tap it, that we could get it within a 90 to 120 day type of timeframe, but always subject to kind of how current economic conditions are prevailing.
And that'd be and that's part of that, what we approved here last year, basically what the bank could use as kind of a back or kind of a borrowing base as that $300 million?
That is correct. So over the last year, meeting with the Legacy Fund and Budget Stabilization Advisory Board, we reviewed the investment policy statement as we do every year. And one of the criteria that we set is that it was established to be at $200 million, but not to exceed 35% of the overall program assets. That was something that we discussed. I think it was actually raised by Representative Gary Kreit, and it's something that we brought forward to the State Investment Board. So that was a change. Historically, it had been at $200 million for quite some time, and that's when we changed it to kind of the 35% kind of limiter, which is much more common. When you think about asset allocations, they're generally more percentage-based than hard dollar limit-based.
Okay. And I think, Alan, are we going to get into that a little bit later on, or do you want to kind of the what-ifs type scenarios and stuff?
Mr. Chairman, I guess a little later on the agenda. I think Pam Sharp is going to talk about budget stabilization fund, and then we'll talk about the legacy fund.
Okay. Yeah, we won't. I thought that's what we were going to do, but I just wanted to check. Okay. Go ahead, Dave.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, if I could direct your attention to the next page. Let's see here. It is on page 4. This gives a highlight of the 1-, 3-, and 5-year performance for the period ended June 30th, 2015. These are all audited results. The first column shows current fiscal year-to-date returns. It's really for the full year, the one-year period ended June 30th, 2015. I'm going to focus on the net column that's after fees. You'll see the budget stabilization fund generated a net return of 1.86%, so a little under 2%. It compares fairly well with, if you go to the far right-hand column, for the 5 years end, it was about 2.28% over the last 5 years. If you look at the policy target benchmark, it exceeds it quite substantially. The policy target benchmark is 75 bips. Again, it's just a function. In this low interest rate environment, it's very, very hard to generate significant income while maintaining a high degree of capital preservation. So the ability to generate a near 2% return after fees is quite positive, quite encouraging overall. Quite candidly, the best return that we've had over the last year and actually over the last 5 years has been the Bank of North Dakota CDs. It's a function of those investments having a higher period, a longer period of interest rate lock, and because of that, rates declining over the last several years, if not the last 15 years, it served us well from that perspective. Any other questions on the performance for the 1, 3, or 5 years per period ended June 30th, 2015?
Any questions? Senator Sinner.
Mr. Chairman, Dave, maybe it says in here somewhere, but what percentage of the money is actually held in cash?
If we were to, Mr. Sinner, Representative Sinner, members of the board, if we were to flip, let's just go here a little bit farther. So it's on page 6. You would see what the cash and cash equivalents are. So it's a little under $10 million. Now, I have to admit, that it does vary at time. When we know we're getting ready to make a distribution to the general fund, it will probably be a little bit higher at that point in time in anticipation of that. But generally, it's a pretty low percentage.
Any other questions? Okay.
Page 5 deals with investment fees. If you take a look for fiscal year ended 2015, highlighted in the green box, investment management fees approximated about 15 basis points, or 0.15%. On a dollar basis, it's about $737,000. If you take a look at kind of what we got for that $737,000 of that 15 basis points, we got a wonderful return on our investment fee dollar. Highlighted in blue at the bottom of the page is 1.11%. It shows the level of outperformance that we achieved by using active management, specifically, bless you, specifically working with BND, Babson, and JP Morgan. So to put it another way, we spent less than $1 million each of the past 2 years on investment management fees. Significant, but still less than $1 million. Pretty good. And you say, geez, what did we get for that? We actually got about $5 million of excess return on our investments, which is a wonderful return. Whenever you can get a 5-for-1 return, we spent less than $1 million per year, generated more than $5 million of excess return using our active management. That's a wonderful situation. I often get asked, what's a more reasonable expectation? Probably like a 2-for-1 return on investment management fees is quite good. So this is a great story. Again, that $5 million number is derived in the bottom bullet point. If you were to take a little bit closer look, it's just you take a look at how much we have in invested assets for the last year. Within the budget stabilization fund is about $480 million. You take that $480 million and you multiply it times 1.1%. That's the excess return over the policy benchmark, and that approximates a little bit over $5 million. So
you're basically just benching off of what the policy is? And
yes.
Okay, so if you had just dumped it in and left it in the bank somewhere and just without any management really other than just it was there.
Right, so Mr. Chairman, members of the board, if we would have just invested the vast majority of these funds in kind of a Barclays government credit index fund, we would have earned a little bit under 1% during the past year. You take into account what we have in the BND CDs in our cash position and our expectation based upon what's actually returned in the markets over the last year was less than 1%. So the fact that we were generating 1.86% is a nice situation. And it goes to show why we use active management. Why do we spend time to go with Babson and JP Morgan or other investment managers to help us beat index returns? So there's a cost associated with it, but when we're getting a 5-for-1 return on our cost, that's a pretty nice story overall.
Well, it's better. I know, you know, and what gets concerning on this here, because I know earlier in this fund here a few years ago, we wound up taking a $20 million hit, and if it wasn't for the Bank of North Dakota's returns, we'd have had a loss on it instead of we had a positive gain. But but I know the bank's been doing, and that's been one of the reasons why I think we've been, you know, willing to go along with the bank being involved in this, because it has been returning better returns.
Absolutely. The BND CDs, with the function of them being a longer-term investment during a declining rate environment, has served the budget stabilization fund quite well. But it's a bit more challenging when you have a turn, when rates, right, we're now in a belief more of a rising rate environment. That's where it's a little bit more challenging. But a good story, and it served us well. The next page, again, I kind of touched on this already. It has to do with actual and target asset allocation. We're very close. We're generally going to be within 1% to 2% of actual and target, so no real concerns there. This next page highlights kind of our one-year performance, 1-, 3-, and 5-year performance, for the period ended September 30th, 2015. So these are unaudited results. Most of the information that I've shared with you so far has to do with audited fiscal results for the financial year ended June 30th, 2015. I did want to provide just a little bit more of a current update. So for 1, 3, and 5 years ended September 30th, 2015, the fund returned an actual return of about 2.14% versus a target return of 0.98. That's in that top column, or the top table. For the three-year impact, it was about a 1.78% return versus a target return of about 0.57. And for the five-year period ended September 30th, 2015, a little bit over 2% versus a target return of 0.4%. So in all three periods, all three-year periods, 1, 3, and 5-year periods, and it generated positive excess return by using successful active management.
Is there anything, any questions, committee, is there anything that the feds do that affects, you know, like what, now I'm hearing they might not even do anything this month, but is this just too short a term to really matter as far as if they do start raising interest rates or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, so U.S. federal policy and global economic policy by other various central banks has a significant impact on long-term returns. And it can, in a very short period of time, it can have a significant impact on a quarterly basis. If there is an expectation that perhaps the Fed will raise rates by a quarter basis points the week of December 14th, it would have an impact on it. Having said that, this investment profile takes into account it being very short duration, so it doesn't have a lot of interest rate risk from a duration perspective. So we're very well protected in the budget stabilization fund from a potential increase in rates, be it 25 basis points in December or something more in future months.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Dave, you may have covered this, but can you explain to me what the manager effect means?
So manager effect, absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardmeyer. Manager effect is really meant to identify the outperformance of the investment manager versus a policy benchmark. So if we selected Babson or JP Morgan to invest in a Barclays government credit like mandate, and they generated, let's take case in point, a 2.09% return for the 1 year ended September 30th, 2015. If we would have just done a benchmark index, it probably would have been closer to 1.2%. So that difference due to manager effect is a result of what the manager did to sector selection, individual security selection, perhaps a little bit of interest rate risk management, but in the end, the manager effect is probably best equivalent to how well the individual investment manager is doing versus the performance benchmark that we've assigned to him.
Well, then take me through the Bank of North Dakota's effect, the calculation of 44 basis points on the actual return and the target return, and how you come up with 44.
So with the 1 year period ended September 30th, 2015, it's really hard to have the best benchmark for the BND CDs. It's because it's very easy to have a benchmark for JP Morgan or Babson because they're more conventional types of investments. For the target return for the BND CDs, we're basically using a very short-term interest rate equivalent, and we're saying the manager effect is 0.44% for the BND CDs. It probably has as much as an impact of how well we've done versus an expectation versus what has actually occurred in the past. But it's that's tough. That's a really hard question to answer. So,
is there any other questions? Go ahead, Dave.
Very good. The next four pages are actually nothing more than just a copy of our current investment policy statement. So this is the investment policy statement that we reviewed with this board over the course of the past year. It incorporates some minor changes that we had previously discussed. You see it signed by Representative Keith Kempenick and myself on the last page of that. And that's it. At this point in time, I'm happy to go through the investment policy statement if you would like in greater detail, but it is something that we spent a fair amount of time reviewing over the past year.
Is there any questions?
Kind of the key component of the investment policy statement is on page 3, and it's the short-term fixed income in Bank of North Dakota CD, which we have a minimum allocation of 90%, bank loans with floating yields is a maximum of 5%, and absolute return strategy is a maximum of 5%. For all intents and purposes, we are 100% invested in the short-term fixed income in BND CDs. So.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Dave, you know, we kicked that 35% around a lot. You know, there was some issues, discussion about whether or not if we were a little more aggressive, we would be able to make some deals that are hanging out there. Could we talk about that just briefly while we're on this?
Absolutely, I'm here to serve.
And where we're at, and maybe that should be for committee discussion. But I know we had that discussion, and has it. Kind of handcuffed you guys, or are we still okay at the 35%?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and you know, maybe for Senator's benefit, let me just explain. This program funds the BND match program, so the CDs in here backstop or fund the BND match program, and so what we had been talking about was that program is capped at $200 million based on the funding level we get from budget stabilization. As you can see in here, right now, that's $91 million. So there's another $110 million, roughly, of ability to fund match programs with. Our challenge came a year ago or so, where we had at least $100 million earmarked for specific projects. Those projects did not come to fruition. So right now, I think we're at a point where we're okay with the $200 million level. But at that point in time, we were, you know, frankly, going to have to shut down the program because we were all earmarked or committed to the 200. So since that project has, you know, not come about, we're right now we're in a good place.
Well, I guess,
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, is this board is one of its responsibilities to approve the investment policy that's in this document?
Senator and committee, we've already done that.
Okay.
That was back in. Well, it's been kind of an ongoing deal with this, but formally we approved it here this last
meeting. Because I noticed it's just signed in September.
Yeah, and it was during session when we were, well, actually it started about a year ago on the discussion of changing how the bank accessed or what they had, because there was kind of a policy between OMB and the bank before that. It was kind of the bank had used this, like Mr. Hardmire said, with the match program, and we more formalized it, I guess, here during the, I think there was a meeting in during the session, we had one, and then in June is when it was pretty much formally adopted, and that's what we were going to do.
Thank you.
So. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, if I just clarify, so we have a policy kind of driver that says we should review it on an annual basis, and the fact that we've done it in relatively recent few months, feels covers our desire to have an annual policy review. Quite candidly, we spent a lot of time discussing it over the past year, so I do feel like we're in a good shape with it, and it's nice to have the signed documentation to support.
Well, and committee, and you know, and it was, these are always abstract conversations when you don't need it, and that was one of the arguments that we were having, you know, probably, I shouldn't say arguments, but discussions probably over the last couple years of, you know, these funds are there and, you know, we want to, like this one here, you want to make sure that it's liquid, and that was probably the bigger concern of how much, you know, and we'll get into that later on here, but it was one of the discussions was, is how can we use this and still serve the purpose of what this fund was established for and stuff, and truthfully, up until 2009, this fund was really irrelevant because there wasn't any money in it, and then it started collecting money, and we've started, you know, it's and now, well, like I said, we'll have some discussion later on what the outlook and what this fund, how it'll work, I guess, so.
Well,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if I, and I know we didn't have the meeting minutes read of the previous meeting or approved at this point, but I look back, I read through the minutes, and there's no comment in there about this policy. And I think it's, you know, on the boards I've served on in the past, policies like this are approved by the board. I think we should have the board, maybe this has been done in the past, but it's not in the last meeting.
No, I think when we approved this was during the previous, I think it's during, it was the previous meeting, and I think that was in April is when we did that, because that was one of the discussions, or was it December, was it a year ago? Okay, time flies. Go ahead, Alan, did you have some?
December of 2014 was when it was officially approved. And just a little bit more background, you know, this board first was established a couple years before that, and then the first few meetings, it was developing the policy and was approved, and then it's been updated a couple times since then.
But we can have a, I mean, you know, like I said, this here, there's been some, I don't care, you know, the committee, we can vote on it again, I guess, if we wanted to, since we do have a new member.
My point is, I'd sure like to review the policy. I haven't, this is the first I've seen of it before we vote on it, so that's, you know, that's...
Well, that's what's in effect now, is what we have now, and if you have some suggestions or something, I guess we can schedule that for another board meeting, because it is a...
Yes, and that's fine, and that's all I would ask anyway.
Yeah, because this isn't, you know, like I said, it changed, it's, in a way, it's fluid. It is, and, but we, one of the things, and like I said, when you do this stuff, it's hard to go back. And that was one of our concerns about increasing, you know, the bank's ability to access more than what was kind of a general understanding before this. And so that was one of the things we wanted to feel comfortable about when we changed. And that was basically the only policy change that we've had since this has been restructured. And I mean, it started in 87, in 87, I think, is when this kind of got passed. It was substantially upgraded in 2000, I think it was 2009. It was substantially upgraded, and that was legislative action that kind of changed that part of it and stuff on it. And then we went as a board has gone, I think this has probably been one of the major ones that we've changed, is what the bank was, the ability to use. I think, according to Eric and the liquidity is there, that, you know, and that was one of our biggest concerns on it. We didn't care how it was used, as long as the liquidity was there when it, if and when it was needed, and that was probably the bigger issue.
Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, and after we approve it, it goes to the State Investment Board yet for the final perusing. Is that, as I recall, how that worked? We give a recommendation, the State Investment Board digs in and sees that we aren't outside of the boundaries of where we were set. Is that, am I correct?
Vice Chairman Klein, that is correct, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board. Yes, so if you look at the bottom, it's very small print. So it was actually approved by the State Investment Board on August 28th of 2015. So there was discussion that we were having with at the State Investment Board meetings, just further clarifying the nature of the changes over the course of the last 7 to 8 months. And it was formally approved, and you can see in the minutes, of the State Investment Board on August 28th of 2015, following a formal approval by this board in December 1st of 2014. Having said that, we had numerous discussions over the past year just to make sure that we were well aligned from a language perspective.
See, and this fund committee is a legislative action fund, so the legislature can, we could use the whole thing. You know, I mean, it isn't voter approved or anything like that. This is all legislative action that formed and can dismantle or use it or whatever. You know, I mean, I don't think we will, but like I said, it's all legislative action that made this fund. So it's whatever the next legislature wants to do with it. That's about how long you got to work with this. So go ahead, Dave. Is there any other questions on the policy part? And like I said, this, if there's something that comes up on these policies, because this has been in the same way with the legacy fund too. I mean, that was a that was basically a year-long discussion. There was a sharp learning curve in institutional investing on that one, and I think we're at a place where I think most of the players are in agreement of where we're going with that, but we'll get into that here next, I guess, isn't it?
Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm going to then move to the legacy fund on page 12 of the presentation. This provides a status update, kind of the history of the legacy fund from a funding, income, and disbursements perspective. In the first column, new money in, that's the amount of the kind of contributions that we receive from tax collections totaling about $3.1 billion over the past 4 years. The net increase represents the income component of about $219.6 million. As you are well aware, there have been no distributions out of the legacy fund since its creation. As of June 30th, 2015, the market value of the fund approximated $3.3 billion. On the next slide, I actually have just some policy timeline to refresh everyone's memory. Back in April of 2013, a new strategic asset allocation was created for the legacy fund, approved for the legacy fund. In June of 2013, the State Investment Board approved the transition plan to fully implement this new policy allocation over an 18-month period. In July of 2013 is actually when the State Investment Board approved the implementation using existing managers within the insurance trust. In August of 2013 is when the actual implementation, 18-month implementation phase started, and in January 2015 is when we actually became fully implemented. So January 31st of 2015, just for everyone's recollection. The next slide is just shows in diagram form kind of the change from 100% short-term fixed income. So it had the same kind of policy allocation as a budget stabilization fund originally, but during that 18-month transition phase, we became invested in 50% equity, including 30% U.S., 20% international, 35% fixed income, and 15% what I would call diversified real assets, including a 5% allocation of core real estate. So that is our current policy allocation at this point in time. And it's been in effect since January 31st of 2015.
Dave, when you look at these, do you look at other state funds, you know, like the Alaska Permanent Fund or the Wyoming, do you have the manage, or do you have, when you talk about, do you look at how their mix is? And I know I do. I got the Wyoming and the Alaska one. I watch, you know, not a lot, you know, and they don't change much either and stuff on it, but you just look at different, the returns that they have and stuff, and Alaska's a little more aggressive than what this one is anyways, but do you compare other state, you know, the states that have set up funds and stuff, do you look at those?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, yes, we do look at kind of other similar type funds. I guess it's important to always realize that we're going to invest according to an investment policy statement. That's what why we meet together and sit down with the State Investment Board, work with our consultants to say we're going to have a 50% equity, 35% fixed income, and 15% other real asset type of allocation. When you look at that type of asset allocation, you do that comparison to other plans without having the benefit of knowing what their particular risk return liquidity expectations are, it makes it very hard to compare. It's much easier to compare pension returns if they all have they're all perpetual versus a fund like this where they can be a little bit more unique or custom crafted.
Well, and that's what I seen, you know, when you did that run for the employee benefit committee and stuff, you know, and that does get to be apples oranges type conversation. You know, I was kind of looking at what you were showing there, mm-hmm. and stuff on it, and it, you know, you kind of, there are different motivations behind it, and that's one of the things we struggled with this to start with, was, well, it's still truthfully of what your, you know, that was always our question, what's your asset goals, what's your goal at
right.
the end of the day and stuff on it, and just to build the fund wasn't really a goal, you know, and stuff, but that's what, you know, right now that's kind of where we're at with it, and but that's why I was just kind of wondering and stuff, because I know, like, Texas has two funds, but those are more or less dedicated to some specific things, and then when you look at Wyoming, that fund's kind of broad in nature too. I mean, it's funding some, you know, there's different components of that fund. It isn't just one fund either and stuff on it, and that's why I was just kind of curious.
No, Mr. Chairman, it's a great point. And the risk return liquidity expectations, the absolute investment objectives can have a big impact on the long-term returns of the individual funds. Within a pension universe, there's generally, it's a tighter correlation, a tighter grouping of kind of the return and risk expectations. There's still variability, but it's a much closer overall versus when you're looking at a fund like this, which is much more unique.
Okay, any questions? Okay, continue, Dave.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, on page 15, we highlight the legacy fund net investment returns for the periods ended June 30th, 2015. This particular page, we're going to show that the legacy fund generated a net return, after all investment management fees and expenses, of 3.3% for the one-year period ended June 30th, 2015. That exceeded our investment policy benchmark by about 75 basis points, so that's quite strong. Again, we are long-term investors. Over periods of short time, equity markets will be more challenged, fixed income markets can be more challenged, diversified real assets can be more challenged. Long-term, if we consistently beat our policy benchmark, the type of return we would be receiving if we were passively invested, we're going to achieve our long-term goals. So again, for the one-year period ended June 30th, 2015, the legacy fund generated a net return of 3.3% after all investment management fees and expenses, and that exceeded our policy benchmark by about 75 basis points. From an absolute return perspective, U.S. equities and real estate were the two best kind of asset classes. U.S. equities were up 8% during the past year, while real estate was up 15%. The more challenged kind of investments were international equity and global inflation-linked securities. If you can see in the chart, our U.S. bonds did pretty well, up about 2%, but inflation-linked were down about 3%. All in all, every single one of our asset classes, so I like to use colors, and I highlight in green kind of the fact that we have net investment returns is what we actually kind of generated from a performance perspective versus our index. And you'll see every single one of our asset classes, be it U.S. large cap, which generated an excess return of 1.56%, or inflation link, which generated a net investment or an excess return of 1.27%, they're all positive, which is all helpful for helping us achieve our long-term goals, even during periods when absolute returns are more challenged.
See, and this is, you know, and that's what you get comments on the street, you
sure.
know, not like, you know, because this is figuring, you know, because it took a pretty good hit there, August, September, and now, you know, there's some, you know, they do, it is kind of the Wall Street casino, and people look at, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and it gets hard to explain to them that this is a long-term, I mean, this is something that hopefully we're riding that out and we stick with their goal of instead of, you know, and that's what I think they look at is chasing a trend, and now we've had that discussion in the past too, is those trend investing and stuff on it, and that's not what this is.
Absolutely no. So we sit down, we did an asset allocation study, and we said, what do we expect equities to return long term? Let's just say round numbers, 8%. So we're going to have a 50% allocation to that. And fixed income was probably more in a 30. It was a 4% long term return expectation with a 35% policy allocation. Other real assets is about a 15% policy allocation. We were expecting about a 6% return over the long term. Now some of these things we say, geez, if other real assets are supposed to generate 6% long-term, what did we actually experience in the past year? We had real estate that was just phenomenal, was up 15%, but then we had inflation link that was down 3%. So over short periods of time, you can't get too overly concerned with what's happening. You're going to say long-term, if you do that 50% equity, 35% fixed income, 15% real assets, and you take your long-term return expectations, we should generate a return of about 6.4%.
Representative Crate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dave, looking through the equities, the large cap and the small cap, and then in international, who makes the decision? We've got 22% in large cap, 8% small cap, and 20% in international. If I was to invest this money, I would have probably went with 8% in international and 20% in small cap, because large cap, small cap, we know the performance there is usually, you know, fairly well, where international is, you know, on the scene right now is, you know, a little bit risky, I would say. So could you explain why we're invested that way
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kreit. So again, it really steps back to what's our long-term views. You're right. Over the past year, international equities far underperformed U.S. large cap or U.S. small cap. But we're not trying to make tactical decisions to say when's the right time to roll into large cap equities or and pull out of international equities. Can that be done? Yes, but it's a challenging thing to do, and that's kind of a form of global tactical asset allocation. That's very challenging to do by any stretch of the imagination over a very long period of time. What we prefer to do is have long-term return expectations for equity, fixed income, and real assets. And that's quite candidly what the investment, legacy fund and budget stabilization advisory board approved, what was accepted by the state investment board, was not only a 50% equity allocation, but also a 30% U.S. and 20% international. So.
Mr. Hardin.
Yeah, that was a question that I had as well. But in terms of the 50% equity breakdown, you have large cap, small cap. Who is the decision maker on that percentage? Is that SIB does that? Your investment managers do that? And then, you know, how come there's no mid cap?
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, Mr. Hardmeyer. So the broad 50% equity allocation is approved by the state investment board, as well as the kind of U.S. large cap, U.S. small cap, and international equity allocation. So those are well discussed and vetted with our consultants. So when we're developing a long-term asset allocation forecast, we're taking that into effect. So it's really not something that we make individual decisions at the retirement investment office and how much we're going to push into targets of between U.S. equities versus international equities. It's clearly not an investment manager decision. We define what the investment managers in U.S. large cap are going to invest with and how much they're going to allocate. So that is a policy decision by the board, including the advisory board and the state investment board, in heavy consultation with our investment consultant with the very long-term view and perspective. It's not a 1 year. It's the hardest thing to do. It's right. We should have all been invested in real estate for the last, right? That we would have generated a 15% return. But that's just not the right thing to do from a long-term perspective. We want to stay diversified and disciplined. And if we can consistently generate positive excess return of about 75 basis points, we're going to hit our long-term goals.
Representative Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize this is long-term investment, but I look at the international scene long-term, 10, 12 years out. I don't see any bright future in international investments at this point, unless something would really change, but I don't foresee that changing. So, if this was my money, I'd be uncomfortable the way it's invested in 20% international. I'd sooner look at domestic. I mean, it's the United States. Let's invest in the United States. That's just my personal feelings, but.
Mr. Chairman, members of Mr. Chairman, Representative Kreit, individual discussions about being international equities overweight versus the broad market versus U.S. large cap or small cap are all good discussions to have. And discussions that we generally have in an asset allocation policy framework. So obviously back in a few years ago when we sat down with this broad framework is when we said investing for the long term, what did we think was the right thing to do after heavy discussion with our Skelton investment board and our investment professionals. And this is what we believe is the right thing to be for the long term. Having said that, you can always have a discussion about at this point in time in the market, are you more optimistic about U.S. large cap versus international equity, and I understand your points a great deal, but again, I can't echo what Mr. The Chairman Kempinick indicated, is that we really do focus more on 8, 10, 20 year type of returns than 1 or 2 years, because it's very hard to identify when the actual turn is going to occur.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I want to make a comment about this whole issue, and it's my feeling that part of the reason for international investments, and these are not small companies, these are probably companies like Statoil, who have interests here in North Dakota. That is an international company. BP is an international company based out of Britain, and this I assume that we invest in international stocks for diversity and for times when the dollar changes. When the dollar goes down, these stocks are going to go up, and when the dollar goes down, our stocks are going to go down. When the dollar goes up, our stocks go up, and when the dollar goes up, their stocks go down. And that's basically, I think, what's happened over the last period. Am I not correct, or am I just making a wild stab at it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sinner, now that's a great point. You said it very well. It's so easy, and Representative Kempinick, he stated this as well, to chase what's ever hot. And if you're chasing what's ever hot, the only thing you're going to be sure is you're going to kind of miss it you're going to miss the actual peak and probably get it when it's correcting. So yes, long-term discipline. Everything cycles over time. International securities will outperform in the future versus U.S. It's just a kind of reversion to a mean. Having said that, individuals can be incredibly successful timing individual moves into U.S. and large cap. It's not what we do. We're not tactical. We're long-term investors with a very strategic long-term allocation. And it's served us well in the past with the State Investment Board. And it's what historically we've done and what we will likely continue to do going forward.
Well, and one of the things, committee, and what do we look at, and we haven't gotten into this, but the cost of doing, you know, if you're going to chase, and like I said, you know, and it's kind of, we've had discussions about this in the, and maybe, I don't know if Representative Crate was on the committee at the time when we were talking about, you know, because this was before we did this allocation. It was the discussion of just putting it in the mattress, and that's what we basically did to start with, and trend investing, and there is such a thing as that, but the costs were, you know, you'd have to do very well to cover the cost of that, because that's, you know, you could move this fund, this 20%, you could probably move that, you know, you could say, okay, let's go to 10, let's go to 5, you know, but it's going to cost you to do that, and that's one of the things, you know, too, is that we're trying to watch the cost of what we're doing here too, because that's where it gets to be to separate the individual attitude and the institutional attitude on it, and it does, and you know, and that's one of the things that we were trying to do was when we set this up was because we had RV Kuhn basically is who we hired to kind of guide us through this a little bit on what that's basically what Senator Sinner, you know, is one of the discussions, and that is right now the dollar, yeah, but it's going to be interesting. I see the IMF approved the yuan or yun or whatever they call it now and stuff too as a competitive currency, so this could be interesting to see what happens there. And that's the same way with the inflation link too, is at some point, you know, it was just kind of, you know, it isn't a big amount, but the thing is that this environment we're living in today, you look at what it was here 15 years ago, and it was a completely different, you know, I mean, so we could have invested for all inflation, you know, at interest rates at 15%, well, that ain't happening either, and so it's hard to chase those trends, and that's what gets, you know, and it is tough, and I don't disagree, you don't like to see red on on your investments, but it's something, you know, I think we're hitting it for the most part, and I think that's, you know, if there is a trend that looks like it's persistent, then we're going to have to revisit, and that's the thing, is this isn't set in stone, but this is where we're at right now and stuff on it, and I think that's what we need to keep in mind, and you know, like I said, if it looks like a trend's longer, then that's it. Go ahead, Representative Craig.
Not to belabor the point, which I think we are, but you know, I realize we were investing long term. I didn't, you know, my discussion was, you know, to eliminate international. I would just adjust the percentages, is all I said. I didn't, you know, I think we're getting carried away on it. So,
understood. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, committee, it's good to have, like I said, this is a ongoing education process with this investment, and I'll tell you, it is an ongoing education. So, any other questions? Go ahead, Steve.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. The next couple of pages just highlight the individual managers that we use in our various asset classes. I'm not going to mention each one, but they're all there. The next page, on page 18, shows the legacy fund return. So now this is kind of a snapshot of what's on our real website, and it shows at the very top, the total legacy fund for the one-year period ended June 30th, 2015, shows a net return again at 3.31%. It shows us what our policy target was and what our excess return. And then it also shows kind of what it was for the prior year and for the 3 years ended. The reason why I'm kind of highlighting this is just to, one of the comments that has been made in the past was show a little bit more manager-specific investment performance. So that's what this does. This is all on our investment website where we show how individual managers perform. If you were to go to total large cap domestic equity, kind of highlighted in the blue column there, or in the blue box, overall, our large cap domestic equity manager are doing a wonderful job. They've generated a net return of about 8.94% versus a Russell benchmark of about 7.3%. So that makes me feel good overall, that overall our managers are doing what they should. If you dial in a little bit deeper, you'll see that each one of those managers is also green. Every single one of our managers outperformed. If you drop down to small cap equity, however, you'll see that we actually do have one manager, Research Affiliates, that underperformed the benchmark. Okay, there are going to be points in time when individual managers are going to underperform. It's an unrealistic expectation to think we're going to have 20 managers and every single one of those managers is always going to be outperforming the benchmark over a one-year period. Things are going to cycle in and out. So that's the reason why we have a diversified structure. But again, if you focus on the blue boxes, we're generating excess return in large cap domestic equity, small cap domestic equity, and also international equity. And sometimes, as sad as it may be, our international equities are doing a great job. The managers are doing a great job. Having said that, we're still disappointed that they lost 2.48% during the past year, but that's better than the benchmark that lost 4.2. So sometimes we're actually paying investment managers to lose less than the market, which is kind of the key to capital preservation, is as crazy as that may sound. But they do a nice job of downside protection. The next slide kind of does the same thing. It goes through and shows how our fixed income and real asset investments are doing. Again, for the most part, a lot of green on that page. The two areas that are yellow on this page where we have a little underperformance is in State Street, and that's 1 basis point, and that's largely an index fund. So just so everyone understands, everybody thinks when you get index funds, you invest in index funds, you're going to get index returns. It's not always the case because there's costs associated even with index investing, but that's a small amount, 1 basis point. The only other area where we underperform is in cash and cash equivalents, again of about 1 basis point, and that's just because it's so hard to generate any short-term income these days.
Dave, I had a question for you.
Yes.
Overall benchmark for the equity side versus the fixed income, I thought I heard you say 8 and 4 long-term. Is that what you're thinking?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mr. Hardmire, that would be a long-term return expectation. So if you were to go back to the RVK or even Callan's capital market projections, the long-term equity returns are going to be in the high 7 to 8% range. Fixed income is probably going to be in the 3 to 4% in range long-term, not in this market, but long-term. And diversified real assets probably has closer to a 6% handle on it. Over a 10 to 20 year period, not over a 1 year period, in which you can have much greater volatility.
So you have the total legacy fund at 353, right?
That is correct.
So you have benchmarks just for the equity side?
Yes, we have. So we're going to, every single individual manager in which we identify is going to have an appropriate benchmark. And it will flow up into support what the overall policy outcome.
Well, what I was looking for was just kind of what are your expectations on the overall equity side, including, you know, domestic and international?
Sure.
Mr.
Chairman, members of the board, just to emphasize, long-term equity is probably going to be about an 8% return, okay?
Yeah.
Fixed income is going to be in the 3 to 4% range, say 4% to keep a round number. Real assets are probably going to be in a 6% range. So if you took the 50% allocation to equity times 8%, yeah, and the 35% allocation to fixed income times 4%, and the 15% allocation to real assets times 6%, you're going to get a number that approximates 6.4%. I'm rounding, in the numbers there, but it's the long-term return expectation of the legacy fund is approximately 6.4%.
See, in committee, and that's the thing, and do you got another, you want to follow up with anything?
No.
Okay. And that's the whole thing, is the risk-reward. You know, you say, well, why don't we just all go equity and get our 8%? Well, there's a little bit more risk with that and stuff, too. And that's one of the, you know, that's always been, like I said, with institutional investing, it becomes, do we want to go, and some funds are, you know, doing that. You know, I use the Alaska Permanent Fund is more risk in there, a lot heavier into the equity markets and stuff, too, on it, and a lot heavier into the real estate, too. And, and like I said, this ain't in stone by any means. If the committee, you know, feels we should need to do more investigating into this, I guess it's something that we can talk about. But at the time we were doing this, we were looking at what, you know, balanced out the comfort zone of what we wanted to, what the risk was versus what the return was and stuff on it. And so that's kind of where we're at with this. And so, you know, like I said, it does, when you listen to it, well, why don't we just get the 8% and then forget about this other? And but it does, we're trying to cover the broad market part of this. And it's, like I said, when you look at this ain't weather forecasting. I wish it was. But we're trying to look at more something that's more attainable and stuff and on a long term. So.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the next page I want to highlight is page 20. It's just the legacy fund schedule of investment expenses. We actually increased our expenses from 27 basis points, highlighted in the green box on the right-hand side of the page. It increased up to 33 basis points. You have to remember, again, that we were in the process of implementing an asset allocation transition, going from short-term fixed income investments, which have very low cost, to equities and real assets, which have a higher cost associated with them, also a higher return expectation. So the fact that we went to 27 basis points to 33 basis points is quite reasonable. I think more important is, if you step back, you look at the bottom bullet point, it says for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2015, active management generated $28 million of incremental income for North Dakota after deducting $10 million of investment expenses. So listen, we spent in fiscal year 2015, $9.58 million in investment expenses for the legacy fund, a significant dollar amount, almost $10 million. But it was a wonderful investment. That $10 million generated $28 million of excess return via active management. So end of the day, we always want to make sure we're prudent with our fees, but more importantly, we want to make sure we're getting good value. And a 3-for-1 return or a 2.8 to 1 return on excess return versus investment management fees is a nice expectation and a nice result.
I see the real estate managers, they were they a lot more active, or what's their fees are?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, real estate is a more expensive asset class. It's less liquid. It has a higher return expectation. It's a good diversifier. I'm happy, again, to emphasize that we were fortunate to earn 15% on our real estate investments for the past year, which is just phenomenal. But, yeah, real estate has a investment fee that's closer to 1% as opposed to short-term fixed income like what we invest with the budget stabilization fund, which is closer to like 15 basis points. So significantly higher expense, but a longer term, much higher return expectation.
Any questions, committee? Okay, go ahead.
Very good. The next page, 21, kind of gives an update for September 30th, 2015 for the legacy fund. In the top right-hand corner of the page is what I'm going to speak to. Again, it's just active management has increased legacy fund returns by over 50 basis points in the past 1, 3, and 4 years. For the last year, so the one-year period ended September 30th, 2015, the legacy fund actually only generated a 0.5% return, so very low. But again, it's a function of what happened in the international equity and debt markets during the third quarter of 2015, in which non-U.S. equities declined by over 12% during the third quarter, and international debt were also similarly challenged. So the fact to have a positive return during a period of significant losses is quite positive. The other key point is here, again, is just at the very bottom, actual asset allocations are all within 1 to 2% of the target level, so that's just something we make sure we monitor on a regular basis, on a monthly basis, and make adjustments as necessary going forward.
Dave, when you interviewed, a month ago you had some managers in, is that just once a year, or is it ongoing, you know, is it different managers ongoing throughout the year?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, our investment team, including Darren Schultz, Eric Chan, Connie Flanagan, we meet with our investment managers on a regular basis. Not going to say daily, but it never a month goes by which we wouldn't be meeting with an investment manager, and quite candidly, it's more on a weekly basis. Sometimes it's done over the phone. You can do a lot by meeting with investment managers or webcasts over the phone. And at times, we do have people, individual investment managers come in and give live presentations as well. So it is a continuous process that occurs on a weekly basis throughout the year.
Go ahead.
Very good. The last four pages of this presentation deal with the investment policy statement for the legacy fund. So again, it's probably worth pointing out, as you look at the bottom of page 24, the policy target. So this is actually, the investment policy statement serves as kind of the instructions on how we are to invest. And if you look at that policy target, broad U.S. equity 30%, broad international equity 20%, fixed income percent 35%, core real estate 5%, and diversified real assets 10%. So that's what we live by. Those are our rules and our instructions upon how we invest after much deliberation and discussion. And that's what I had for my prepared remarks today, but I'm happy to address any questions at this time or any other point in time in the future.
Any questions? Mr. Hartmeyer.
I have a question that, you know, as we look forward into 2017 when this becomes available for spending, can Alan or somebody remind me you know, the income becomes available, right? Goes to the general fund, right? What is the definition of income?
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, Mr. Hartmeyer, Alan, do you have you're probably more skilled at answering that than myself?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hartmeyer, during the last interim, we had the budget committee, the government finance committee, studied the and looked at the future use of the legacy fund, and it did introduce a bill last session because the Constitution, when it talks about income of the fund, it's not real specific. It says income earned after June 30, 2017, income of the fund is transferred to the general fund at the end of the biennium. So the question that the committee looked at, well, you know, it's clear that the income earned after that date would be transferred, but what about the income that's been earned up to that date? So that committee did introduce a bill to the last session clarifying that the income earned prior to June 30 of 2017 would become part of principal. That bill was passed by the legislature, however the governor vetoed it. So right now that question is really still up in the air.
Okay, but let me clarify. Does income just include dividend and interest income, or does it include capital gain appreciation? What is income?
Right, and there was a bill passed earlier that did clarify it's realized gains and losses. Unrealized gains and losses would not be part of income. It's only realized gains and losses.
Dividends, interest income, and realized gains.
Yep.
And Alan, I know that it is poorly written, that constitutional, you know, because we debated that from the get-go, but I was always under the assumption that there's a question whether the interest earned or the income earned prior to 17 could be, because it...
Right.
I know it's not written very well. I was always under, because we went round and round about that, but I thought but that was just in this committee. Because I know that that bill was to put the future up until the legislature decided, it wasn't an automatic that the earnings be, or the income be, that was the question, that's what I thought that bill was trying to do, was the question that it wasn't an automatic transfer into the general fund, you know, before January of 17, you know, and the question became too, you know, and that was one of the discussions, like in our committee, was, are we talking the 17, actually it'd be the 1920 would be more of when you could actually use it, you could appropriate, but you couldn't use, it wouldn't be available until, because it would be through the 17 session before that money, or could you use that money during the 17-19 biennium?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah, the discussion was that the money does get transferred at the end of the 17-19 biennium, so it will be revenue for the 17-19 biennium, so therefore the legislature will have that money available during the 2017 session when it's developing the budget for 17-19, that income. And the, you know, the constitutional measure indicates, you know, the state treasurer shall transfer the income, so really it'll be the state, unless the 17 legislature provides some more guidelines, or, you know, identifying what that income is, if it's the earned, what was earned prior to June 30, 2017 or after, you know, it would be up to the state treasurer, probably working with the attorney general to identify just, you know, what was really meant by that.
Yeah, because, well, I know there's, I think there's a bill or what is going to be drafted or is drafted, but looking at the property tax or the mill buy-down using earnings to shore that up, and I don't know, what is our, do you have any projections for like next biennium, or haven't you run anything of what the earnings would be on the legacy fund for, you know, like for the next, for the 17 biennium? Have you done any rough, what, you know, kind of looking into the crystal ball?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, what historically we've done is looked at what we've generated in the past year or two and kind of continuing that forward. It's a pretty conservative assumption given the fact that we haven't been fully implemented in our asset allocation, but it's a conservative way to project. If you wanted to be more theoretically accurate over the long, long period, we should be taking the 6.4% return times the asset base. Again, it's a function of what additional fund flows are going to be coming into the legacy fund via tax revenues. So it is an involved discussion.
Well, we're, you know, you can see that from what we've,
sure,
you know, we're, you know, what we get deposited into the Northern Trust account is a third of what it was,
yep,
last year, you know, and that's what the, you know, and that's why I always you roll your eyes when you, you know, I mean, it and that's been one of the whole things about, you know, you grow up and live in Western North Dakota and look at all this mineral income, that's the whole problem with spending it all, because it quits coming in at some point, and not that it's ended, but I mean, you can't, you know, you can live like a king for 1 year and be a pauper the next, and that's been, that, you know, and that's kind of what this fund has been trying to do too. But I just, like, the earnings part of this is going to become a debate, well, it already is a debate, on what we're going to be looking at, because I think that's everybody looking into their crystal ball and seeing where some of these funds are going and what the, you know, and they're granted they're legislative, but boy, you start talking education and human services type funding, it gets pretty hard to be discretionary about it, and so that's where I think that's going to be, we're going to, that's why I was just wondering, and maybe for the next meeting, that's probably what we're going to have to look at, is kind of where we're at and what we're looking at for earnings and stuff like that, and to the next biennium anyways, and probably the foreseeable future is more than likely, because if once you start that, if, and it depends what the legislature does on it, but that's going to be one of the discussions, I think, is how to...
Go ahead, Senator Klein.
Oh, and Mr. Chairman, and just theoretically, if today was the session and we went to Alan and said, Alan, how much, what have we got available to put in the budget? What would we say, what would we tell him today? What would you tell us? You know, what we're talking about, realized, unrealized, where are we at? Where would we be where, with actual money that legislature could spend. Do we know that yet? Or do we, what would you tell us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe we'd have to work with the investment board to find out what their estimate of earnings is going to be for that biennium. And then, then depending on how you're going to define the earnings prior to June 30 of 2017 or after. It really seems the next session needs to...
Well, the idea, Alan, would be that we would base it on an estimate, or would we have to look to a number that was more of a hard number? You know where I'm going here? Because in 6 months, the Greece or China or whoever could implode. Would we be trying to develop a... Well, you said an estimate. I guess it is an estimate, but... Dave, you want to, or anybody could comment to that. I guess I'm just thinking, this is, we're talking liquidity here. We're talking things going up and going down, and we saw the market go like this and like this, and all of a sudden, there isn't as much money in the bank as we thought.
Understood, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Vice Chairman Klein. On this page 12, it shows what we actually generated income for the last 2 years. So it was $113 million for fiscal year 2014, $99.9 million for fiscal year 2015. That's total income. It's a key question that was asked by Mr. Hardmeyer about what's realized versus unrealized. So it would be probably no more than that $213 to $14 million. It'd be some subset of that. Looking historically, right? Looking forward, much more challenging to estimate what's going to happen over the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months. It's always been my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the allocation coming out of the legacy fund would be backwards looking, not forward looking. So I would think you'd be looking at what happened in, this time period, what's actually transpired so far.
Well, in committee, I think, we get into this debate on, and we might have to go back to the inception of this constitutional measure. I remember sitting, though, in committees, and the conversation at that time was that I think the intent of the legislature at that time was to keep the earnings up until 17 in the fund. And we're probably going to have to define that a little better than because I think the bigger debate on this last bill that we had in this last session was taking future earnings and rolling it in, not letting it go. I think prior to, but if there's question, we're going to have to get that more clarified, I think, because this $219 million and whatever we earn for the next year and a half here, I think is the intent was to leave it in the fund. And truthfully, this is way beyond. I mean, I think we were hoping to get $1 billion by June of 17 when the original conversation took place and stuff on it. So this is way over what the conversation was at that time. But I think the intent, if you go back into the minutes and stuff of these committee hearings, I think the intent was, though, to leave that the earnings in there. Then the 17, after the 17 earnings were up for grabs, and like I said, it depends on what the legislature decides to do with that and stuff on it. But the truth is, like I said, the constitutional, that's been one of the debates since we've been reading this, that could have been drafted. Well, it's so broad in statement that you can interpret a lot of things into it, but I think that the intent was to leave it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the fund, and the way I look at it is, if the citizens of North Dakota wouldn't have passed this, that money would have been spent. I mean, it would be gone. We wouldn't have no $3 billion sitting there. To me, I look at it as money that's not there and should stay there, and it should accumulate. That's the way I look at it. I hope, as we go into the next session, we've had some uptick. If not, maybe we got to look at tightening our belts a little bit, because, we've been rather generous over the last couple of bienniums. So But as far as I'm concerned, that $3 billion that we've got banked away should stay in the bank. That's my personal feelings. And looking, you know, not for 17, but 27, 37, to have some of that money there. That's my personal feelings. And I think most of the people and citizens in North Dakota probably look at that fund the same way.
Senator.
Oh, Mr. Chairman and Dave, back to page 12 that you have on the screen there, and you talked about the net increase as income. But that is not all realized gains.
Absolutely correct.
And so is it going to be fairly simple for you to say what's realized gains and what's unrealized gains? And I suspect that 90% of that is unrealized gains. Maybe I'm wrong, but there's some number that's going to be a lot less than that number that's really realized gains, correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Senator, yes, it'll be a subset of that number. I wouldn't hazard a guess. I know we have the ability to track realized versus unrealized. Having said that, I haven't actually gone through and done it myself.
So in reality, the amount of money that the legislature is going to have available is going to be far less than probably the income number that we see.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Senator, it will definitely be yes, without a doubt.
And that's the whole thing with this fund, you know, and Representative Kreit's right. The thing is that, like I said, when you grow up with and seeing what happens with mineral income, and that's where this is coming from, is that at some point in the future, we are going to have to rely on these types of funds to kind of keep us in the style we're used to living. And that's why, you know, you always kind of grin a little bit when you see a little bit of a correction, and that's what this basically is, what we're probably going to look at here the next year or so, is and it is going to be a reality check, there's no doubt about it, because you can't have a growth of a straight line up and expect it to sustain itself. But this here, you know, and I think there was a private group out, and I think Mr. Hardmeyer was part of that, and that. You know, if you do, I sense out to members here in the past, there is an organization that does sovereign wealth funds and stuff on it, and I've said this a year ago, we're just beginning in this. Like I said, Texas has two funds of it's $86 million apiece, or billion apiece in them. Wyoming's 15, 16 billion, New Mexico's 18 billion, the Alaska Fund somewhere between 50 and 60 billion, and so there, you know, that's the whole thing, and I think that fund, or that group that put together, you know, and if you do have some control on what you do with this, you know, in 30, 40 years, our good chunk of our state budget, I mean, if you do control yourself, could be provided for out of this fund, but it takes some self-control and stuff on it in the meantime. But anyways, I guess we're on the policy. We were at the end of the presentation and stuff on it, and I don't know if anybody, you know, has got, you know, we kind of had a good discussion on how the allocations were put together on this, but otherwise, if there isn't any more questions, thank you, Dave.
Thank you very much, and members of the board, appreciate it a great deal.
Okay, well, it takes us, we're not too far out of time, takes us to the presentation of legislative staff regarding the potential effects of low oil prices on the legacy fund, Alan.
Yeah, we're gonna
have Adam. Oh, a new victim, huh?
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Adam Matiak, Legislative Council. So you should have received a memo in your handout at the beginning there. It's a legacy fund what-if scenario. So that's the one I'll be talking about here with you. Basically, the chart at the bottom of that page there is a little trust fund analysis for the legacy fund, compares the May legislative forecast against this what-if scenario. And the main changes between the what-if and the May forecast revolve around the beginning fund balance and then the oil tax. We didn't want to make any assumptions about the investment earnings, so we just continued that across the board for the sake of comparison. So the May forecast, as far as the oil numbers, that was based on oil ranging from $42 to $53 and production at 1.1 million barrels per day. That May forecast also assumed that the large trigger would be in effect for the first 6 months, therefore reducing the oil extraction tax collections during the first 6 months. The what-if scenario, a little bit different for the oil there, reflects actual allocations through the first few months through November 2015, and then going past that, so December through the end of the biennium, those allocations were adjusted for this what-if, and that what-if scenario was based on oil being $16 lower than the forecast for price, and then production decreasing from its current level at 1.16 million barrels down to 1 million barrels by the end of the first year, and then continuing at 1 million barrels for the second year of the biennium, and then also assumes that the big trigger takes out any effect from the large trigger because that did not take effect. So you can see a change there of about 211 million between the oil tax allocations under the May forecast to where we put it with this what-if scenario. And then that's offset by the $28 million increase on the beginning fund balance, so about $183 million lower at the end of the 15-17 biennium based on comparing the May forecast in this what-if scenario.
So, Adam, what you're basically, since the big trigger didn't hit, now, because I know we get those... The number was bigger, though, than what we forecasted. Where do you reflect that in here? Because we had estimated of 950, and then the what-if, that was the actual collection then, was the 738?
So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so this would be, those numbers would reflect the total 15-17 biennium estimate. So the $950 million was the estimate at the beginning for the entire biennium. The $738.68 million would include actuals through November and then forecast for the remainder under this what-if scenario. So the additional revenue that we received in the first few months is offset by future reductions for a net of a $211 million decrease.
So that's reflecting going to the 10% then, or to the basically the 10% then instead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's correct. Yes, it would reflect that 10%.
Okay. But then Ryan had a nice little thing yesterday, or was it yesterday, wasn't it? Or I was listening. I was trying to listen on the radio while I was, and you know, and that is interesting. It's always. We get into the same debate about technology. How many buildings would we have to have on here if we'd have kept things going 20 years ago the same way as we did 20 years ago? And how many buildings would you have to house people to do the paperwork? You know, these, and that's what gets to be an interesting conversation. It is, and you know, sometimes you know, we do the right thing sometimes, even though it might not be the as clear when it's going on. But anyways, so
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I have a question.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, can you break down, Adam, what the collections are year to date through November 30th versus what is projected in the what-if scenario? Because if I recall, under the May forecast, there was $0 projected for the period the first 5-6 months of the biennium, correct? Because they thought the trigger would go into effect.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the forecast, it would have been very small, but it would not have been zero on the oil extraction tax side. It would have been about rough estimates, would have been about $10 million a month compared to, you know, if the trigger did not take place, about, you know, $100 million per month. So just kind of some rough numbers there. But as far as the breakdown of the actual collections to date for the legacy fund, or the actual allocation to the legacy fund to date, it would have been $170 million. So August 2015 through November 2015. So that $170 million would be incorporated into that $738 million.
So if you subtract that from the $738 million, what's that number? That's seven, just say $740 million. So we're talking about $570 million?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes.
So basically our projections from January 1st of 2016 through the end of the biennium are down about 40% from the projection. From approximately $950 million, maybe $900 million, down to $570 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess as a rough number, yes. I guess that would be one way to look at it.
And had we left the extraction tax at 6.5%, how much higher would that number be for the remainder of the biennium beginning on January 1st?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that would be a tricky question because if the tax rate had remained at 6.5%, and the large trigger provision.
Let's just assume that the trigger stayed where the trigger goes off. Let's just say we left it. If you recall, the bill was divided for the question in the Senate. All of us voted to eliminate the trigger. We did not vote to eliminate the tax, to reduce the tax. My question is, beginning on January 1st, if the tax remained at 6.5%, how much more money, based on this projection, would that fund have in it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't have that number offhand. I would have to take a look at that.
But if you use the formula and divide the $570 million, which is what you're projecting, divide that by 5% and times it times 6.5%, you'll come up with a number, correct? And sure, that's rough math. But it's basically about 20 to 25% more than the $570 million, or somewhere around another $100 million to $125 million, correct?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as a rough estimate, that would probably be a ballpark.
Thank you.
Yeah, and committee, yeah, you know, this is getting into an academic debate here, but, you know, you're assuming that the companies would stay here. That's been one of, that was one of the, because we're still getting questions because the cost of doing, especially in these price environments, Texas is a lot more attractive, and so is New Mexico. And so, you know, this is all academic, that whether, you know, that the 1.5% difference of what we did, truthfully, I wouldn't have supported taking that trigger or having it where I wouldn't have personally, because the companies went through. The law was is what it was, and if we'd have left it at the 11.5%, I know I would never supported taking just that had been a tax increase in my mind on it. And so that would have been a nice academic debate, and we could have rolled the dice and seen what happened here, because I'd have voted to let the 6.5 go, and we've done it before, and historically, I think it would have been a close vote on our side anyways, and truthfully, I don't think it would have passed to just take the trigger off. So that's all academic on it. We're in the environment we're in right now and stuff on it. So I think, Adam, thanks for this here. You know, it's what's been coming in. I know when we get the Northern Trust deposits, you can see from I think July of last year, I think there was a deposit of $117 million for 1 month. And I think that was a high this year, but I think it was like 40, 46 million. So we're getting about a third, and these last ones were 35, 32, and they were in the 80s, close to 90 million last year. So we're running two thirds off of where we were a year ago is just from collections and stuff on it. So it just kind of highlights the environment that, like I said, with this, with mineral income, you never you never put that into an ongoing account. I mean, it shows up, hey, if it's in the bank, it's there. But boy, you start trying to put a fixed budget on mineral income, we're gonna find out how much the state, we'll find out the character of the state here in the next year and a half on it. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Adam, what I've heard yesterday, or some of my colleagues talked about these dynamic fiscal notes, and as we look at, if we're looking at some a reduction, we've always found that, for example, in their discussion on income tax, is that as we've lowered it, we've provided more income tax. By lowering this, there could be a dynamic on the other side that could create additional income also. I mean, and when you're doing fiscal notes now, it gets to be a little more challenging, I understand. Certainly there is a lot of theory and thinking and numbers that would suggest that dynamic fiscal impact is there. There's something to be said about that.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's tough to weigh all the different factors. You know, as you mentioned, currently the fiscal notes are done in a static form, and it's just the most direct effect that results from it. And some of these dynamic ones try to incorporate, you know, future impact and secondary impact. And, you know, if the tax rate is decreased, maybe there's more drilling activity, and therefore in the long run, maybe more revenue. So it is difficult to try to pinpoint and capture those nuances and then show the net effect for those dynamic notes. But it is something that we certainly kind of keep our eye on and look at.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Adam. Okay, well, we went through the low oil prices, and hey, Adam, you didn't have a projection on what they're going to be a year from now, have you? We're done. Thanks a lot, Adam. We're going to go to the 10-20 item presentation by Representative's Office Managing Budget. Is that you, Pam? Okay.
Around.
Oh, there's. We're trying to keep you in the dark. Yeah.
We're sitting here again. Brothers of the brush, come on.
For the record, Pam Sharp with the Office of Management and Budget. So, does everyone have a copy? There are a few extras here, if are on the table right there. If not. First of all, I just want to review the statute for the transfers from the Budget Stabilization Fund and also the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund, and then I'll go into some of the numbers that I put together for you. On the first page, it's the Budget Stabilization Fund, and if you go to the shaded amount, this is kind of the gist of how the money would actually be accessed. The amount transferred from the Budget Stabilization Fund upon order of the governor may not exceed the difference between an amount 2.5% below the general fund revenue projections for the biennium of the most recently adjourned session and the general fund revenue projections for the biennium by the director of OMB. So basically what it's saying is we look at the revenue projections when the session ended and compare that to a new revenue forecast. And at the very beginning of the statute, it says, if the director of OMB projects that the general fund revenues will be at least 2.5% less than the original estimate. So the only way we could do that would be through a new revenue forecast. So we take that new revenue forecast and subtract it from 97.5% of the original forecast, and that would be the amount available to be transferred from the budget stabilization fund.
So excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
So what you... So right now we're showing, you know, running excess of 5%, 7%, mm-hmm. you know, as of
behind
our projections. Now, if you did a new revenue forecast, would I'm still trying to, because our appropriation amount is X, you know, that's kind of a fixed number there. You know, I mean, we can change it because it isn't mm-hmm. obviously, we've got this set up basically to, but to kick in the 2.5% allotment to start with. Now, does that go along with the new revenue forecast, or is that with the current revenue forecast? How does this process start, I guess, you know, to get going? You know, that's what I'm kind of, and I think that's what's going to be the ongoing conversation.
The process starts with a new revenue forecast that would be directed by OMB. So that would start the process. Once we have the results of that revenue forecast, then we would compare it to 97.5%. I have, so I'll ask for some direction from you. I do have a spreadsheet that kind of goes through the math. Mm-hmm. If you would like to go through that, I'd be happy to do that. Otherwise, the attachment that I have here is just summary numbers that are just kind of cut to the chase. So I'll give you the option of whether you want to go through the math of how we got to those numbers, or if we just want to talk about.
We got some time. I think we, if we could.
Yeah.
I think the more that people understand okay. how this is going to play out, I think the general, I think pretty much, I think around the table probably understand how this. And I know budgets, we're going to get into more on this in a week and a half anyways and stuff, but I think that we're going to have to understand how this is going to play out and how much, you know, because like I said, right now it's showing like 112 or something like that. I think the last one are roughly somewhere in there, you know, and how much of this budget stabilization fund is going to get used or potentially could get used and stuff on it. And I think that, you know, the more better we understand how this works in actuality, it's always interesting, like I said, over the last 3-4 bienniums, you know, since we've had money in this, you know, it's always hypothetical, but it's just kind of, we look at it, okay, mm-hmm. and move on. But actually, if we do start using it, we'd like, I think most of us would like to understand how it.
Okay, before I hand out this other spreadsheet, I want to go to the second page and just review the allotment process.
Okay.
Which basically, because it all ties together and there are two separate statutes. So the allotment is made by a specific fund. In this case, if it were to happen, it would be the general fund. So all departments and agencies that receive money from that fund would be allotted on a uniform percentage basis. So this would be the general fund, and our general fund appropriation is about $6 billion, roughly. But it says, except that appropriations to DPI for state school aid, transportation, and special ed may only be allotted to the extent that the allotment can be offset by transfers from the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund. And then it goes on to say the first 2.5% from the general fund will be offset with the transfer from the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund. Before an allotment is made, so this is the one condition that an allotment can be made, the director of OMB has to find that the monies and estimated revenues in a specific fund are insufficient to meet all the legislative appropriations for the fund. So that's the only requirement that fits here. So it's actually all kind of a complicated process, so we'll go through this spreadsheet.
Yep.
Okay, does everyone have one?
Yep.
Okay, for starters, when I prepared this spreadsheet, it's kind of been an iterative process, and so it's not necessarily everything's in the right place. So for starters, go to the middle of the page where there's a little bit of shading, and it says calculation of the 97.5%, because this follows along with what the statute says, that it's limited to 97.5% of the original forecast. So when the legislature adjourned, the estimated beginning balance for this biennium was $598 million, and the revenue forecast was $5.6 billion. So that was a total of $6.2 billion. Take that times 97.5%, and we get the $6.081 billion number. So that becomes the new number that we have to work with when we have a new forecast to compare to. Okay, so if you go to the next column right above that, there's a scenario there that says a $600 million shortfall and 2.5% allotment. Go to, again, sort of the middle of the page, right on top of the shading. So this scenario would assume that there's a $600 million shortfall. We start out with our new comparison number of 97.5%, which is the $6.081 billion. And then we compare it to the new information. So the actual beginning balance was $729 million. If you'll recall, we picked up about $130 million from turn back and excess revenue. So the actual was $729. Okay, and so that list, assume we had a new forecast that showed a $600 million shortfall. The original forecast of $5.6 billion goes down to $5.0 billion, and that totals beginning balance and new forecast totals $5.7 billion. We subtract those two numbers, and this would be the allowable amount transferred from the budget stabilization fund. That shows $313 million.
Now, Pam, that's a total. Is that the education in this number too, then?
No, this right now, what we're talking about is just how much could be transferred from the budget stabilization fund. Okay, so now jump to on top of that. So this would kind of run through what would happen if we had that $6 billion shortfall and did the 2.5% allotment. We'd start out with, this would just kind of look, is what our status of the general fund would look like. Our beginning balance plus our the new scenario of revenues that were decreased by $600 million, so we get the $5.7 billion. Subtract our appropriations, and our original appropriations were $6.026 million, but DOT got $20 million of a contingent appropriation because a trigger was met, so those appropriations increased by $20 million. Okay, a 2.5% allotment would amount to $151 million. It'd be 2.5% on the $6.046 million. And then the offset from the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund would be $44 million. So then we would have total appropriations, if you will, of $5.9 million. It would show that we would be short $171 million after a 2.5% allotment. So that's how much we would transfer from the budget stabilization fund, even though right below it, it showed that we would be allowed to transfer 313, we'd only need 171 million. So the rest of these scenarios, the next one is a $500 million shortfall, and it's just doing the same math, only we have we just lost 500 instead of 600. This shows that we would still need that whole 2.5% allotment. However, that we would only require 71 million from the budget stabilization fund. And then if you move over to a $400 million shortfall, we don't need the whole 2.5% allotment. If you do the math, we would need about 1.85% of an allotment, and it would bring us roughly to zero. And then the very far column, a $300 million shortfall would show that we don't need any allotment at all, and we don't need any money from the budget stabilization fund, and we would end with 21 million. And then, okay, just so I had to always have to make sure these numbers make sense to me. So a $300 million shortfall shows that we'd still be able to make it, and that's because the legislature left a balance of $211 million. We picked up $130 million, so that's about $340 million that we would leave laying on the table. DOT got an extra $20 million, and so then this would leave $20 million for an ending balance. So, you know, 300 and below, we wouldn't need an allotment or a transfer from the budget stabilization fund. If there was a shortfall more than 600 million, you can do the math. Instead of 171, there'd be more money coming out of the budget stabilization fund. And then at the bottom of the page, this is just different allotment calculations. With the 2.5%, the net amount to the general fund would be $106 million because $44 million would be offset by the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund to get to that $151 million number. And then it's just the same math for a 2% or a 1.85% or a 1%. How much would be cut from the general fund? How much would come from the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund?
So, Pam, if like on the 300 million scenario, we really would we need a new forecast to you really wouldn't call it for a new forecast,
except we wouldn't know what the shortfall amount is going to be unless we did a forecast.
Okay.
I mean, right now we know we're 112 million short in 4 months, but to project something out to the end of the biennium, you know, we really would have to have a forecast to find out if it's only going to be 300 million or if it's going to be 600 million.
Okay. Because the scenario I'm looking at is that, okay, we get into, you know, July and we're sitting around 300 million, you know, because there is a trend getting, you know, we kind of had that debate here a month or two ago. There is kind of a trend showing that we're under, we overestimated, and I've always maintained the last couple sessions, if we hit our estimates, we're in trouble and we're below it. So we're you know, and but the thing is that, you know, we do have a cushion there, you know, and I mean the stabilization, you know, to use it, it's all right. It's just that the thing is, though, is that I know there was some, I think the chancellor had a little clip here last week about, you know, get ready for a 2.5%, you know, and that just affects their general fund appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
But it does start, you know, you start looking at it actually going into next session is what gets to be more concerning, because once you start that, then where do you start basing a budget on? You know, do you base it on the 97%, or do you base it on what we appropriated last session, and then go from there, you know, basically, you know, because even if we basically use the appropriations and we wound up using the budget stabilization fund to meet that, you know, even a zero based budget is too high. So where do you know, that becomes, it's an academic conversation, but it becomes where do we start that? And that's probably more your problem than it is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, but it's going to be ours too, because
mm-hmm.
as we
yep.
get into you know, a year and a half from now, a year and a couple months, you know, we're going to be having to look at that, and you know, and it looks like to me that we're probably going to be dealing this as the session starts, if if this trend continues, that looks like we're going to be coming in, you know, the last six months of this current biennium is where we're going to have, you know, and there's some stuff we could probably do with the legislatively too, but it does make it for, it complicates things, put it that way.
Go ahead, Senator Klein.
So, Mr. Chairman and Pam, so we need a new forecast? Are we going to get, what are your thoughts on the forecast?
Senator Klein and members, I think it's very likely we'll ask for a new forecast. I have been in conversation with Moody's about the possibility. You know, obviously, November just finished up. We want to see what November's numbers look like and, you know, weigh that. But it's definitely looking like a trend. And especially with sales tax, it doesn't appear that there's anything that's going to change that until the price of oil, you know, bounces way back up. So I think it's probably very important.
Would there be a timeline? Did you, in your mind, is there a point where
in my mind,
in November, we're like this, we got to get her rolling?
In my mind, the sooner the better. Once we make that decision, then the sooner the better. And that is because if we do have to do an allotment, the sooner agencies know that and can deal with it, the better it is and the easier it is for them to do that. It isn't that I worry that we would, you know, run out of money, right? But that's not it. But if we had to do an allotment, the more months an agency has to deal with that, the easier it is.
Well, and
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pam, thank you for being here. Do you think $600 million is probably at the very top end of what we could see in terms of lost revenue?
I have no idea.
I have no idea.
The reason I have $300 million at one end and $600 million at another on this end is just to be able to see how it impacts the budget stabilization fund. I really have no idea.
So if I'm looking at this, and I don't know what the projected ending balance was, unobligated balance from 2013-15. So, and our number was up quite a bit over that, correct?
Right. When you left town, thought it would be $598 million. It turned out to be $729. So we picked up $130 million in our beginning balance for the current biennium.
So, and based on the revenues, we're spending about $1 billion more than we're taking in this biennium, correct? Based on just on your sheet here.
Because your sheet here.
If you have a $600 million shortfall, you're spending about $1 billion more than what you're projected to take in.
Well, those would have been in, if we had, wait, say that again.
I'm just subtracting the appropriations of $6,046 million, and I'm subtracting the revenues, which are $5,038 million.
So that would be if we had a $600 million shortfall.
Yes. And tell me, what was the shortfall for the first quarter in sales tax again?
3.4%.
I didn't bring those numbers.
About 110.
Well, it wasn't that. The first month. No, it was 3.4%. I can't remember what we had, but that's, I remember the percentage. But
probably 90 million.
About 90 million. And we have about how many more quarters left in the biennium? About seven. Right? Well, that's about, could be, if you extrapolated that out, that's about $630 million. And what are your projections and thoughts on income tax? Have you had any?
Income tax is coming in very strong. Individual, especially, is coming in very strong, which tells us that everyone's out there working. And as you just look around, you can see, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm going to talk just from my personal experience of dealing with the ag sector. I can tell you that the ag sector is going to be down significantly in 2015. I think 50% of the farmers won't make any money this year. Now, you're going to always have some folks that had carryover income from the year before that are going to have to report, pay some tax. But I think it's definitely going to affect revenues in the future, and I think it will affect revenues for 2015 going into next year. I think it's going to affect us significantly, but I'd really like to get Ryan's take on what you think about what's going on there. Mr. Chairman, all good points. I think that what I've seen on the sales tax versus the income tax side, when you look at all the wells that have been drilled and unfracked, for example, those 1,000 unfracked wells, 2/3 of the sales tax that comes from each well is actually from the frack stage and not from the drilling stage. So you see that big inventory of unfracked wells, that's a huge part of our sales tax base. That's why I think that we've seen the biggest differential from forecast and sales tax. Why I personally think that income tax so far, we have not quite seen the decrease, the deviation from revenue or from forecast. When I talk to companies that are out there where we've had some of the biggest hit in the oil sectors, that they still have a lot of employees that they're keeping on. Some are keeping full employment, even though they maybe have a third of the production activity, because once the toughest thing to replace is the talent that they've built up over the years. And there, a lot of them are keeping employment. Maybe even not at the $100, a week or anything, but reduced hours. But they still have incomes. And if they did lose their job, they're going somewhere else in the state and finding jobs too. You know, we have 17,000 open jobs right now in the state. A lot of them are getting filled. So on the income tax side, I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen some very, very strong actuals compared to projections. That's at least what I've seen so far. Things could change, but a lot of the capital intensive activities like the drilling, the fracking specifically, that when you talk about $250,000, $300,000 per well, and most of that dealing with fracking, that's where I think we've seen such a buildup of that shortfall. But that's one of the first things that will be drilled again too, or will be completed, will be those first fracked wells that are out there, over 1,000 of them. So you could see, if prices start to come back, you know, if you all of a sudden frack 1,000 wells, that's a lot of sales tax. It's one of the first things you'll see come back. So you can kind of see this whipsaw effect because of that capital intensive activity. But that's the reason I think we've seen such a disproportionate decrease on the sales tax side.
And like the ag committee, and on the ag side, and I think one of the things that is probably, you know, on the sales tax side, you know, the equipment wise, but a lot of that is probably offset on because a lot of, especially crop producers, the last few years they've upgraded their, but they've also taken accelerated depreciation and stuff, so it kind of offsets what they've been paying, you know, mm-hmm. on that, and it's probably more federal. I know on me it's more federal that you got nailed on the state, your tax, you know, what you pay. I mean, you pay some state tax, but it's the federal side that you get. I roll my eyes on that, but I think that's one of the things that on the ag side, you know, and you probably won't see the income-wise, you know, there might be some decreasing because, yeah, I think breaking even this year is going to be, you're going to be above ground, you know, on it. But I think that's one of the things we've seen the last few years, is especially on the ag side, if they, you know, if they've been buying, they've been offsetting it with the depreciation part of it and stuff too. So I think that's probably why it won't probably be as big as what you'd expect on it. Mr. Hardy.
Yeah, Pam, I have a question for you, or maybe a couple. Can you go back and tell me what the number, the shortfall is on revenue through the last reporting period?
Through October, $112 million.
So another question is on the allotment. So it's a 2.5% allotment. Is that against our total general fund budget?
Could be.
Or what's left of?
Up to, no, total. What was appropriated of the original appropriation, it would be an allotment against the original appropriation.
Well, so to your point, I mean, if you don't do a revenue forecast until next summer, and half of their budget has been spent, and then you take 2.5% off the total,
that's
it could be really tough.
That's why it's important that if it's a possibility to look at it as soon as possible. Yeah.
Well, see, and that's Pam. When do agencies start developing budgets? That starts like in March or so. You know, I mean, when kind of
for next biennium, we'll probably release guidelines at end of March or April.
See, and if you're going to do new revenue, you know, you're going to have to do it sometime in that time. You know, sometime in that, you know, because that's what I said. This thing is kind of like a domino effect. Once you start this, it gets very interesting to, you know, for the future biennium, you know, especially the nearby one, because then you're going to have something to work, because I don't think the legislature is going to go along, you know, on a revenue based on budget stabilization numbers, you know, and stuff on it. That's going to be a hard sell. It is. And so that's why, that's just a comment.
Well, fortunately, we'll have a little more information by the time the governor releases guidelines.
But that's why I said it's going to be right in, you know, if we're going to do it, you're going to have to do it sometime in that time frame there, because otherwise it could be for, well, like I said, we'll find out the character of the state of North Dakota. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just explain the last page of my first handout. It's just a summary page of numbers picked off this bigger spreadsheet. So for those of you who like to look at a spreadsheet and try to make it work, try to make the math work, you're not necessarily going to be able to do this. So it's just based on a revenue shortfall, what the allotment percentage could potentially be, what the net general fund allotment amount would be, what the transfer from the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund would be, what the transfer from the budget stabilization would be, and then the last column is what the law would allow to be transferred, which we would not use, because we have that cushion as a for ending balance.
Em, how much is in the budget? Or the Foundation Aid Stabilization?
About $675 million, roughly.
See, that didn't, we were using like $900 million there earlier in the session, you know, because that was, did we change that?
Or no.
Did we cap, okay.
No, there is a, there will be a vote. I think that there will be a vote on what happens with the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund, right?
See, now, in that on this 400, okay, that's just the K, that has nothing to do with the mill levy buy down or any, this 440, I mean,
the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund?
Yeah, has nothing to do with, because that is part of the funding, you know, I mean, that does roll into how K-12 gets funded.
The Foundation Aid.
That's already, I mean, that's a given number that was in the bank, but that has nothing to do with this here.
The only use for the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund right now is to offset an allotment from the general fund, so okay. only for K-12 education.
Okay. Any questions, committee? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Well, I guess we can open it up just for committee discussion on, or have, is there anybody that wants to testify in the, okay. I see we got a guest. I don't know if you're a guest or not, the Speaker of the House. You enlightened or well, I don't, as going forward here, I think we had a little with Dave, you know, maybe some clarification on, you know, I think we got the earnings, we've kind of nailed that down, what is the definition of earnings, but I'm a little bit perplexed here. I didn't know, I thought we had kind of settled the conversation with you know, what Alan brought up with the I guess maybe it'd be more directed at Alan. Can you get some history on what the conversation or in committees and stuff on you know, where the beginning and the, you know, because I know most conversations I've been in has been after June of 17, not before, as far as what was available. And I know back, you know, going back 5-6 years of when the conversation was going on, that was kind of, you know, my understanding, the intent was that it's helped build up the fund, and then when it hit the 17, it was, earnings were available to the general fund and stuff on it. And then the 15% to the, you know, that the legislature could access and stuff on it, truthfully, but, you know, who knows, you know, I mean, if that becomes a reality too and stuff on it, but can you put some history together or anything on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the Government Finance Committee had lengthy discussion on that last time, so we can summarize that and send it out to the members if you'd like.
Well, if it is, if they don't do something, you know, we probably should as a bill draft or something, you know, to clarify that a little better if it isn't something, because that does kind of change things a little bit. And the question I was kind of getting at, though, is like, if there's been some conversations about using the income from the legacy fund as a stabilizing force on this mill levy buy down, and that's where, you know, this next, and I think that's going to become relevant here for this next biennium, is that I know there's going to be one bill draft coming in, or that's being talked about anyways, to use some or all of that for basically the property tax, but it's mill levy buy down is where most of it goes and stuff on it. And that's where, you know, to come up with some type of number that, you know, what that's looking at and stuff on it. And, you know, I don't know, you know, that becomes the crystal ball type deal, but I, you know, if we can look at what we've been doing and then come up with a number, I guess, is something that might be helpful and stuff on it for the next meeting. It is. So, any other comments, questions? Huh? You don't like comments?
No, I made.
Oh, you made yours? Well, you know, I don't know. I think you broke it down pretty good, you know, as far as what the 20% on the international, you know, and it is a tough, I mean, well, and that's the problem with a state like ours anyways, is the, and I don't know how much the dollar affects the commodities in general, but I think commodities in general are an export issue, and if you're not competitive on the world market, it just makes it harder to. And you're even seeing that with the beef prices. I mean, when they ship ground beef all the way from Argentina and undercut you got issues going on and stuff. And I'm sure a lot of it's just the exchange rate is what's making that. And somebody made a comment the other day, they're shipping wheat all the way from the Black Sea all the way to the East Coast, and it's undercutting us on chicken feed from, you know, we don't, but from Illinois to Virginia, you know, that's not, and they're shipping it cheaper than they are. So it you know, this commodity is an interesting deal and stuff on it. And there's right now, I don't see anything changing on that. So anyways,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Not to beat this horse any further, but I'm looking at the investment policy statement for the legacy fund. Page 23, you know, it clearly states here that interest earnings accruing after June 30th, 2017 are transferred to the general fund at the end of each biennium.
And that's what, see.
Isn't that pretty clear?
Well, that's what I always was under.
But then what's interest earnings? That's different than dividend income. That's different than realized gains.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mr. Hardmeyer, yeah, it's right. It's not a defined term per se in the investment policy statement, but it's my understanding the investment policy statement is trying not to overstep its bounds by what's stated in the laws or the statute about how you define earnings and the allocation. It's just trying to summarize it. So I don't view this as a summary of what.
So this statement here is not.
It's less than, it doesn't provide enough detail to be able to fully define. Plus, there's a legislative session that takes place every 2 years that obviously can supersede it.
But see, this number one, what you're this is the constitutional measure. See, and that's what I was always under the assumption that it, you know, that it wasn't, you know, that it was, but yeah. I don't know if we need to clarify it better than, yeah, because I know we, well, you were sitting here, I mean, this, when you get into that measure, it isn't well-written, you know, it's broad, but that is fairly clear of what, when stuff can be spent, but if the income can be spent, you know, that's where it goes into the fund, but can you pull it back out again? You know, see, because then you start getting into this, how much did that $219 million contribute? See, and that'd be more my question than if you're going to get into that scenario, because there you got interest on interest or income on income generating, you know, well, where do you start dividing that up and stuff? Is it the income that the income generated, or is it, you know, that stayed in there, but if the $219 million generated $10 million, is that available to the you know, I mean, that could be questionable, you know, on it, because it says income. I was assuming all income, but it doesn't really say that either, you know. So I don't know if we need to get some history on that.
I just one thing, Mr. Chairman. The Constitution does not say interest earnings. It just says earnings. But it does reference accruing after June 30, 2017. But the legal discussion we had in Government Finance Committee was, apparently that's not clear enough, that it's just the amount earned after that date. It could include earnings prior to as well. So that's why the bill was introduced, to clarify that it was just earnings after.
Yeah, well,
the principle included the earnings that were earned prior to June of 2017.
And there was a little more to that bill, though,
yeah,
too, because
yeah,
it rolled the future earnings into it, too, you know, and
correct,
stuff. And wait, I didn't realize, I guess I read it, but I didn't realize that there was a two-part to that bill, because that's, you know, well, it passed the legislature, but like I said, with the governor vetoing it, doesn't matter. But that should have been clarified a little better than, you know, or we should probably. But if you could get some history on that, and just, you know, because it well, yeah, well, not, well, this, we should have some history, though, on what the conversations were in the past. Yeah. Because we're getting into that time frame where he's going to be up for grabs. So, well, Dave, is there any other directions or anything that the committee... I think we'll probably be doing this in June again.
Great.
Here, and we'll see what it looks like. See what it looks like 6 months from now.
Thank you very much.
So, thanks a lot, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Okay. Now we've had. Well, I think, yeah, we'll have to. Well, I think we'll plan for sometime in June and get that. So. Well. If that's all for the good of the order, I guess,
yeah.
Got to move. Second? Moved and seconded. Do we need a vote on anything like that? Nope. Okay. Well, I guess we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well.